first caught the foraging bug growing up in Wausau, where he learned to gather wild food in vacant lots, backyards, city parks, and at the edge of town. He was a cereal and milk kind of kid, and he craved more. It is the spring foraging edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Samuel Thayer has been foraging, fishing, hunting, camping, and studying nature since childhood. Today, he's an internationally known expert on edible wild plants. He's been teaching about wild edibles for more than two decades, and his latest book is Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. He joins us from the village of Bruce up there in Rusk County. Samuel, welcome to the program.
I am delighted to be here on this fine morning.
So give us a better insight of how to go about foraging and what it really means.
My best insight that I can give you is that you learn it and you do it one plant at a time. So it's not like learning a language where you have to know grammar and you have to know a whole bunch of different things to make it work. If you know one plant, you can take that one plant and incorporate it into the food that you already cook. And that makes it easy to grasp and easy to adapt it into your life.
Well, foraging has been going on since hunting and gathering, since humans really walked this earth. So how has it been done traditionally?
Well, you know, the answer to that could be really broad, depending on the cultural context. I mean, at one time, all of our ancestors got all of their food by hunting and gathering it. So we know it's something that works. But every rural culture has incorporated the use of wild food to some extent in their food economy. And it persists today as a rural tradition throughout the United States. But there's a limited number of plants that tend to be used in every region. Fiddleheads and wild leeks or ramps are really well known. And, of course, maple syrup is so commonplace and normal that we forget that it's a wild food. And, you know, blueberry picking, raspberry, blackberry picking. So those are really strong cultural traditions in rural America still. And for me, foraging is just expanding on those more normal things to plants that are just as good, but for cultural reasons, not as well known.
Or not available, readily available in our supermarket.
Yeah, I mean, that is what I like so much about foraging, is the amount of produce available to you increases by an order of magnitude. I mean, you know, there's two or three leafy greens in the grocery store, and there's 200 or 300 leafy greens that you can pick from the wild. And I'm not even including stuff that I consider marginal, not worth your time. I mean, that's really astounding.
One of my favorite things in your book is that you put this grid system there and it goes by the season, and you can see what's coming into season, what's in peak season. So give us a sense of how we could get going here in Wisconsin foraging as we are in this early spring season.
Well, for me, right now where I live, we still have about 2 feet of snow. So I was tapping maple trees yesterday on snowshoes. So that's my wild food gathering activity for this time of year. But as soon as that snow melts and the ground is thawed out, two things will happen. One, the root vegetables that are in the soil become available. And, you know, we have a few root vegetables that we can get in the grocery store, you know, carrots, parsnips, potatoes, you know, maybe celeriac for the people that are adventurous. But in the wild, there is probably 60 or 70 good root vegetables that grow wild in Wisconsin. And the other thing that happens right away is a lot of the native plants and even some of the non-native plants are really frost hardy, and they are ready to be picked as soon as there is sunlight hitting them. They start growing. So our wild leeks and our native wild garlic, both of those will come up almost as soon as the ground is thawed. And sometimes they're even coming up, they're even 3 inches tall in the snow as the snow melts. Things like wintergreens You know, that's a mustard, you know, a cruciferous vegetable, and it has that name for a reason. It's entirely frost resistant, so the leaves can freeze solid and thaw out and be just fine. You can pick those as soon as their ground is uncovered in the spring. And there's really quite a list of greens that are available very, very early in the spring, earlier than you'll really get anything out of your garden.
You might mix these greens into a salad, or how, or do you just eat them on their own?
Well, I do. I make salads. I nibble on them when I'm out in the woods. And another thing that I like to do is, it's maybe been villainized a little bit over the last few decades, is fried greens. Take a nice oil and dice some onions and fry up your greens with that, and you have incredibly nutritious and I think delicious side dish to go with almost any meal. And of course, this time of year, I'm craving greens. So that's probably my favorite way to eat greens. And if you do cook them, you will eat a lot more of them. And some of the nutrients are destroyed by cooking, but a lot of the nutrients are not. And so you can just load up on those plant nutrients that your body's been craving all winter.
Oh, so they'll cook down a bit, and then you get that density and that rich flavor coming through.
Yeah, they cook down, and they become more digestible. And a lot of the greens, like lettuces, like dandelions, that have a faint bitterness, the oil actually counteracts that. It prevents your tongue from tasting the bitterness that's water soluble that doesn't pass through the oil. And so that's one of the reasons that all over the world, healthy bitter greens are fried traditionally in almost every culture.
Samuel Thayer is with us. His new book is Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. You can join in this Wisconsin weekend at 800-642-1234. What do you pick in the spring? What is your favorite foraging tradition? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Samuel, you've been out tapping maple trees. Can you tell us about this process?
Well, we make syrup the old-fashioned way still, with buckets, and cook it out on a wood fire. We have about 2,000 trees tapped now.
Wait, 2,000 trees tapped now?
You know, as far as a commercial operation goes, that's pretty small.
Okay.
But as far as a bucket operation goes, that's quite large. I don't know anybody that runs more buckets. There probably is. Once you get the sap, you need to cook off the water to concentrate it, and it's a pretty simple process, at least the technical aspect of it. The hard part is figuring out how you're going to get your sap out of the woods to your evaporator.
How do you do that?
Well, my neighbor has a tractor that hauls a wagon, and we have tanks we fill as we collect. And I've got a very steep hill on my property, so I have a system where I fill barrels with sap, and then I pump it down into a tank at the bottom of the hill. We pick it up and haul it to the evaporator.
Where
that
are you cooking?
It's easier than it is, though.
Yeah, where are you cooking all this?
We have an evaporator in the shed on my neighbor's farm. We partner to cook syrup together.
And then when you're done with the season, about how much syrup do you have?
It really depends on a lot of factors, but with 2,000 trees, say if we have an average season, that'll be about 500 gallons of syrup.
That's a lot of syrup, though. That's a really good haul for a very small operation. What are your favorite ways to use your fresh maple syrup?
Well, in our house, we use maple syrup as almost our only sweetener.
Ah.
We have it to sweeten tea or coffee. We have it in our hot cereal, and we've altered almost every recipe that we use to figure out how to incorporate maple syrup rather than white sugar. So if we make it, whether it's an apple pie or even cranberry sauce, we alter the recipes slightly. So maple syrup is about 69% solid. Mm-hmm. So if you just take a little bit of moisture out of each recipe to compensate for that liquid that's in the syrup, then things will come out pretty well.
Shishi restaurants have started to put wild edibles on their menus, perhaps to give dishes a little more interest or an exotic flair. Thinking about dandelions, wild asparagus, cattails, wild garlic. Samuel Thayer stays with us for this conversation about spring foraging on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. He runs Forager's Harvest. His latest book is called Incredible Wild Edibles. Gathering your thoughts on your favorite foraging traditions, what do you pick in the spring? How do you prepare your foraged foods once you bring them in? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back after a news update here on the Ideas Network. Especially as spring heats up, wild edibles will be all around us. Most are nutrient dense as well. Rose hips bring the mother load of vitamin C. Lamb's quarters are an excellent source of vitamins B, K, and 6. Hazelnuts contain protein, fat, and fiber. It's a spring forage edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin's resident forage guru Samuel Thayer stays with us. His new book is Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you going around tapping trees right now? How is this season's harvest? Have you gone foraging before? If so, where do you go? What plants do you look for? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Samuel, let's talk a little bit about safety. You mentioned that a few adults per decade will die from eating random, unidentified wild plants. That's a very small number, but foraging still poses some health risks. What advice can you share to help us identify plants with absolute certainty that they're edible?
Well, the advice is so simple that you already gave it in the form of that question, which is just that you need to identify the plant with absolute certainty before you eat it. And if you look into cases where people have poisoned themselves, which is really rare, I only discuss it when people ask me. It's so rare. But they are invariably people who ate a plant without even attempting to identify it. So it isn't like these are caused by people misidentifying plants. These are caused when people eat a plant having no idea what it is and making no attempt to figure out what it is. So I tell people to use the banana test, which is you've probably never picked up a banana and been like, wait a second, maybe this isn't a banana. So you're certain of what a banana is. So when you're that certain about anything, you're ready to eat it, whether it's strawberry or lettuce or anything else. And each one of these wild fruits and vegetables is actually perfectly distinct once you are familiar with it. So it takes the process of reading through a couple of sources or spending some time looking at the plant with a person who knows what it is and points it out to you before you can build up that familiarity that allows you to recognize something. But once you're there, you'll have it for the rest of your life. And that's why I tell people to learn plants one at a time.
In urban areas, is it a concern whether you might be foraging in an area where it's been sprayed with some type of herbicide or pesticide?
It certainly is. And that is the most significant danger associated with foraging. Now, I don't know of any instances. I haven't heard of any instances of people being poisoned that way, but it's harder to track that sort of thing. There's no agency that I know of keeping track of those incidents. But, you know, there's a lot of spraying going on, and it's not just in urban areas. It's perhaps more prevalent in rural areas. So, you know, for me, I try to forage in areas where I know the location and I know what's going on there. You know, there's certain places that are just off limits, like near railroad tracks, for example, those areas are sprayed very heavily. The sides of highways often are. The perimeters of agricultural fields, unless they are organically managed, are usually off limits. So, but there's so much foraging to be done in your own backyard or in areas that are obviously not sprayed or subjected to herbicides, that there are still a lot of options. And I can't give you really a broad rule for avoiding herbicides, but using common sense, you can.
Let's go to Greg, who is waiting in Bloomer. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
Thanks
for the show. I like this one. What I tap in the spring is box elder trees because they are a cousin to the maple, and they're readily available around the creek bottom I live. So I was just, another one. And then my question is hazelnuts, when do you harvest them? And give me some info on those.
All right. Great, great questions. Samuel, okay. Go ahead.
Well, I'll start, first of all, with the box elder. I first started making maple syrup from box elders also as a child, and by tapping box elder, the range at which you can make maple syrup just expands to cover almost the whole continent. I've seen great groves of box elders in New Mexico and Arizona. The box elder is a maple, and the sap is fairly sweet. A lot of people are surprised to hear there are some large commercial operations in Canada that tap box elder, as many as 2,000 or 3,000 trees. So it's definitely a doable thing, and the syrup is great. For hazelnuts, usually I would start harvesting them about the 15th of August. You want to get them when the husks are green still. Well, usually they're still green, but the nut starts to turn brown. If you try to wait for the husks to turn brown, you're going to end up with most years the rodents or the bears getting the hazelnuts before you do. There are times that the animals are going to eat them all before they're even ripe. That definitely happens. The crop is variable, but when there's a good crop, like there was last year, in some places we could pick hazelnuts into October. But most years, the bushes are picked clean by about the 10th to the 20th of September.
Let's go to Margot now in Madison. Good morning, Margot.
Wow, I'm going to get on the phone and call the city of Madison and the city of Fitchburg because I'm worried now. I go foraging for nettles in the spring, and one of the places I go is the Dunn's Marsh area that has been turned into bicycle paths. Do you think they spray around the bicycle paths? I don't see any evidence of it, but off to the sides of the paths, there are nettles, and I don't think people realize how delicious they are, or I'd have a lot more competition for it. But
Margot, how do you use your nettles?
Well, I don't mind getting my fingers burned by the chemical. I'm careful when I snap off the stem. Stinging nettles will sting you, but when you put them in a fry pan, which is what I do, and saute them in olive oil or whatever, those sticky elements that burn your fingers sometimes when you pick them completely go away, and you can eat it, and there's nothing. But I think people are put off by the term stinging nettles.
Mm-hmm.
You could wear rubber gloves, thin rubber gloves, and pick them, but I don't even bother. I just expect I'm going to get a little bit of a burn, but it goes away in about 15 minutes for me and is never very severe. I guess I'm not real allergic to it. I wonder if maybe by exposure I could become more allergic. Maybe your interviewee knows whether if you pick stinging nettles repeatedly, could you develop more of a sensitivity? But I don't find it anything more than momentarily annoying. But I am worrying now about spraying. I'm wondering, do they spray along those bicycle paths? Or
Let's get some insights from Samuel on nettles. Samuel, go ahead.
Well, I doubt that they spray along the bicycle paths, but I can't, say that for sure. But if you frequent the area and you've never seen a sign that of spray, as in wilting, dying plants, then they're not spraying it. And that's what I mean. You forage an area you're familiar with, and you're able to piece together what's going on there. And I agree, nettles are fantastic. They're one of the earliest spring greens. Stinging nettles come up quite early. And I do not believe that you can your reaction is going to get stronger over time to nettles. It's not a classic allergic reaction. There's actually tiny hairs that are injecting a concoction of chemicals into your skin, and people. Some people react more strongly than others, but I think the biggest factor is how thick people's skin is. People that do certain work with their hands and have thicker pads in their fingers can just pick the nettles without getting stung. I won't get stung on my fingers. If the nettles touch my wrist, then I'll get stung there, but I won't get stung on the palms of my hands or my fingers at all.
Samuel, where do these wild plants get their wild names? There's lamb's quarters, smartweed, curly dock. Where do these names come from?
You know, cultures name things, and a lot of colorful names come from the associations with the calendar. So if it's something that's eaten, lamb's quarters is a calendar association, and so is wintergrass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's called Barbarea in Italian, and it refers to St. Barbara's Day. So a lot of these refer to the time that they're collected or an animal that's associated with eating them, like chickweed, sheep sorrel. And a lot of times also there's a geographical association in the name where people say, oh, those people over there, they eat this, and that sort of is preserved in the name. But, yeah, the names are fun, but they're also confusing because a lot of plants go by multiple names. We get plants like shepherd's purse, and that's named for the shape of its seed pod. I've never seen a shepherd carrying a purse. I actually don't think I've ever seen a shepherd. So I wouldn't know what kind of purses they carry, but apparently somewhere shepherds carried a triangular bag of sorts, and that's how that plant got that name. And what's interesting about these plants is that every one of them is a traditional food for somebody, or at least has been. So shepherd's purse is just an obnoxious weed in everybody's garden and everybody's yard in Wisconsin, but it's grown as a vegetable in parts of China. And if you look up Qicai, I think it's spelled Q-I-C-A-I, that is a vegetable that is used in spring wontons in parts of China, and is very highly esteemed and is even imported to this country for culinary use. And they're onto something because it's a fantastic and incredibly nutritious vegetable.
Margo, thanks for the call, Margo. Let's go to Maddie now in De Pere. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. I have a question and a comment. Things like dandelions, do they kind of change over generations? Like, I know that dandelions were brought here from Europe because they were used as a food there. And but it seems to me that here, anywhere you see dandelions grow, it's where fertilizer has been used. And, of course, today all the fertilizer is synthetic. And so could you answer that question? Because it seems like anywhere that dandelions would be growing these days, they would be polluted.
Maddie, thanks. Samuel, dandelions.
Well, a lot of our feral plants that aren't originally from North America were brought as vegetables and have changed somewhat in that as they have gone feral, they've lost the pressure of the selection of people growing them. So you have things like parsnip and asparagus, where the wild form is almost identical to the cultivated form, just maybe a little bit rangier, a little bit skinnier, but essentially it's the same vegetable. And that may have happened with dandelion. They have varieties that are bred for bigger, lusher leaves, but you certainly can find dandelion in places that are not toxic and sprayed. I know because I have a lot of them in my field and in my orchard and in my yard, and we don't spray anything. So they do thrive in good agricultural conditions, just like a lot of plants, but they also will do quite well in areas where they're perfectly acceptable to eat.
How might we use dandelion in cooking?
Well, the traditional use of dandelion is as a fried green. Usually, it traditionally is fried either in olive oil or with pork fat, and either one is really good. And, you know, if you go out and you try a dandelion leaf at any time of the year, you're probably not going to find it all that great of a vegetable. But if you are conscious of the requirement to get it in early spring before they bloom, the leaves are harder to collect in quantity because they're smaller.
Yeah.
But they are really good. I mean, I think they are just a fabulous vegetable, and a lot of the negative feelings towards dandelion as a vegetable come from the fact that people collect them too late, and also from the fact that in our modern American culture, we don't eat a lot of bitter greens, which I think is to our nutritional detriment, but it's not a common part of our culture anymore to do that.
So you're taking the leaves of the dandelion, not the stem, not the bloom, the leaves.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main part used for food. I'm sorry that I did not specify that. You can eat the stems and you can eat the flowers, but those are culinarily really different than the leaves. But the main thing sought is the leaves in early spring before it blooms.
So, which brings us to equipment. What is good equipment to getting at these very specific wild edibles and parts of a plant?
One thing that's great about foraging is you don't have to shell out money on a bunch of equipment. I was asked once what my favorite piece of foraging equipment is, and I showed my 3.5-gallon food-grade plastic tub, and someone just laughed at me, but that's what I use more than anything else. I have a pair of scissors that hangs in the kitchen that's the foraging scissors that I use for shearing leaves. Sometimes it makes it a lot faster. And, of course, I have a shovel, and I have a little trowel, a dandelion digger for digging small roots. But there's really nothing you need that you don't already have. And that is what is so great about foraging. You really don't need any specialized equipment to be great at it.
You just can literally just go out and do it.
Yeah, yep.
Let's go to Liz in Viroqua now. Hi, Liz.
Hi. I just want to recommend so highly your books, Samuel Thayer. They are by my side here in my country place, and I use them every year. I always learn something new every foraging season from your books. And the thing I want to comment on is how the depth of experience of this guy, they totally outshine every other guidebook I've ever gotten.
Oh, that's brilliant. Liz, thank you so much for calling in. And Samuel, that's a real passion there, writing these books as well and sharing this knowledge.
Yeah, well, I want to say thanks to Liz. It makes me happy to hear that the books have done what I hoped they would do when I wrote them. I started foraging as a child because I was hungry and because I was fascinated and it was fun. And it has never failed to bring me joy, and I wanted to share that joy with people. And sometime when I was maybe 19 years old, I realized that other people were interested in this too. I thought I was the only one. Mm-hmm. And I realized that people wanted the knowledge that I had, and so for the rest of my life since then, I've been still accumulating knowledge and still trying to learn new things, but I've been sharing it whenever I've had the chance. It makes me really happy that, I mean, I can share this incredible gift that I've received and this gift of nature that's offered to all of us, that I can help other people experience that and really feel the deep ways that foraging does change your life and your perspective on life.
We're talking with Samuel Thayer, our trusty guide on this foraging edition of Wisconsin Weekend. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite wild food and how do you cook your wild edibles? Let's discuss after this news. According to a recent study by the Center for Livable Future at Johns Hopkins University, not only is foraging on the rise, but it's thriving in major urban centers like Baltimore. In smaller cities like Madison, groups are working to create more so-called edible landscapes, including Madison Fruits and Nuts and UW-Madison's Edible Landscapes Project. It's the spring foraging edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's resident foraging authority, Samuel Thayer, stays with us. He's written several guidebooks to foraging, including his latest Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. Join in with your foraging experiences, your foraging questions at 800-642-1234. Where have you found gold? Where do you go to forage? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well.
So two plants that my great aunt and uncle, when they were alive, that they introduced me to, one was the mulberry, which I actually was confused as a child because they always said the monkey chase the weasel around the mulberry bush, but it's more a tree. And the other one is winter garlic. And those were two of the big ones that I look forward to in spring and early summer. And as for the dandelions, my great aunt Bee, when she was alive, she made the most delicious honey dandelion wine. It was fantastic.
Oh, wow. So how do you use your winter garlic?
Just fry it in the pan and, you know, just similar to how you'd use regular garlic.
And your mulberries?
Oh, I just take and wash them and eat them. Put them on ice cream.
Excellent. Samuel, your thoughts?
Well, mulberries are fantastic. Mulberry is one of the plants featured in my my new book, Incredible Wild Edibles. And we have a very common non-native mulberry with purple or sometimes white fruit. And then we have a quite rare native mulberry, which is a gorgeous tree with enormous basswood-like leaves, which also has delicious, slightly more raspberry-like purple fruit. And that's one of my favorite fruits, my memories of childhood. My grandmother taught me that tree when I was about 8 years old. And a lot of people don't know this, but the young spring greens of our native mulberry are a fabulous vegetable. I mean, they taste a lot like nettles, actually.
Hmm.
And when he says winter garlic, I don't know if he's referring to a cultivated garlic or our non-native wild garlic. But there is a quite common non-native wild garlic that barely makes it into southern Wisconsin, but it's real common in the Chicago area or the Detroit or D.C. or New York. And that is a winter perennial that grows only in the winter and is dormant in the summer. It takes the opposite approach to most plants. And that is milder than cultivated garlic and is, I agree, is a very nice vegetable and a weed that many farmers detest.
Marcus, does that describe what you're picking?
Yes, it's definitely one that's dormant during summer. And, yeah, it's absolutely fantastic.
Well, Marcus, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Larry now in Kingston. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I have a question. Oh, when I was a little boy, I'm 65 now, we used to go into this woods in Cudahy, and we'd find these wild strawberries growing in the woods. Do you ever run across that anymore?
Yeah, we have two native wild strawberries in Wisconsin. We have the woodland strawberry and then the common wild strawberry. The woodland strawberry is also found in Europe, and it's usually a little bit more pointed, and the seeds are not in a little pit or depression like cultivated strawberry or like our common strawberry. And the woodland strawberry, the fruit is not quite as aromatic, also very good. We get a decent patch in our yard in they like a semi-shaded woods with a light canopy. So, yes, I still find them regularly.
Larry, thanks so much for the call. Samuel, I feel like this question should come with a disclaimer because it could certainly use a whole show, but people are crazy for morel mushrooms, highly sought after here in Wisconsin. What are your insights on those?
They like most soils, but not clay, and they do not like areas that tend to flood. Find them under dead elm trees during the first 3 years or so after the elm trees die. Find them under dying or dead butternut trees. Find them in dense stands of white ash, particularly middle-aged white ash, but really any age will work. Sometimes under dying hickory. There's a lot of associations you can find them in. anywhere that has burned, the year after the burn is likely to find some good morel patches. So keep your eyes out during the time when tree leaves are opening. So morels start about when the tree leaves start to bud out. They end about when the leaves are fully leafed out. So typically that's from about May 5th to June 1st is about the length of the season. So hopefully that little bit of info will help some people.
Very nice preview on that. And as we start to wrap up here, are there any plants that we should absolutely avoid?
Well, there's a short list of dangerously toxic plants, which I don't want to villainize those plants. They're just doing what they do, and you should absolutely avoid any ones that are poisonous. I mean, water hemlock is common throughout the state, and that is probably the most toxic plant in North America. And a normal-sized bite could be enough to kill an adult, as in a mouthful. People have survived eating small amounts of it. But again, that's not it poisons people because the root has this big cluster of carrotly things that smell almost like carrots, and they look like a vegetable, and they're crisp, and they snap like a carrot. And every now and then someone finds one and thinks, oh, this looks like a vegetable, let's try it. And that's a bad idea. But there really are not that many dangerously toxic plants.
So forage away. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And happy foraging. Samuel Thayer has been teaching about wild edibles for more than two decades. His latest book is Incredible Wild Edibles, 36 Plants That Can Change Your Life. And he joined us there from northern Wisconsin, where he runs Forager's Harvest. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. March is sugaring season in Wisconsin, when that liquid gold of nature starts flowing from the state's maple trees. It's a sure sign that spring is here. Commentator Justin Isherwood comes from a long line of tappers, and today he reflects on a favorite March ritual.
To middle March, I bring my family's old alliance with spring woods, specific to the audacious habit of the maple tree, and a sap that tolerates freezing temperatures of late winter. It is early June before the oak tree decides to leaf. The maple has flowered and gone to seed before the oak is wakened. This is how it began for my great-grandfather, who left for a week in the woods like so many farmers in the northern communities. Places like Plover, Wapaka, Antigo, they deserted their comfortable homes for the woods and a week of sugaring. Unlike other farm routines, sugaring has a sense of celebrancy. For some, it is a good excuse to go to the woods when it is delicious to be abroad and outdoors. That sense hasn't changed. Sugaring comes before the farmer can pull open the doors of the tractor shed when his yard is a mire. In the modern age, it is hard to justify sugaring. I have crudely calculated I could sell the firewood for more money than the syrup is worth. Were maple syrup on the same economic plateau as single malt whiskey, it would be different. Still, there is to morning pancakes an allure that isn't for Aunt Jemima to do. I will say the same for vanilla ice cream and peanuts that become intoxicating when anointed with late-season maple syrup. And as long as we're defining subtleties, neither is maple syrup from the store shelf the same. Great syrup is the batch method. I'm quite biased on this matter. Maple can be done by reverse osmosis. It can be done by the patent straw evaporator, but neither are the same as the heathen approach of sap boiled and reboiled in a single batch opus, the sap heated maliciously to the dark side of dawn. This syrup is the color of a mink pelt, an umber just this side of coal. Beyond is the hint of wood smoke. It is around this version of maple my family has congealed in the woodlot for 150 years, donned galoshes and mackinaws and set for the woods through slush and windfalls. This is how my grandfather, the great uncles, our neighbors, the hired man, select Indians and the hop girl ended up with their fingers in the seam of this family tale, connected by Middle March and maple sugaring. In the woods they hear the sound of red wings, the crisp holler of the sandhill across the marsh. Days tending the sugar fire, The children listen to stories of the kind told in the woods for good reason. They can't be told elsewhere. And when the sap slows and the trees cease, they might then have enough of wild ways and leave the woods and go back to being farm kids, to sleep in a bed and almost enjoy farm chores, and to sit like good Christians at the supper table. This is the gentle cause of the old woods and those who yet go with Middlemarch to tend the maple, to kindle fire and a soul of another color.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. You can find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. This edition of Wisconsin Weekend was produced by Nyasia Ellison. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.